Welcome back to the U.S. Naval History Podcast. I am your host, Chase Dalton. This is part five of a series that started out as a little bit of research on the largest naval blunder of the Revolutionary War, and in fact, the largest naval blunder pre-Pearl Harbor, but has since expanded into this monster of a series. But no matter, we are now in the middle of a siege. The British are outnumbered, but building up their defensive fortifications by the hour. The small British fleet is also badly outnumbered, but they have wedged themselves into a brilliant defensive position that Commodore Saltonstall, who commands the American naval element, just can't crack. And so what was meant to be a get-in and get-out expedition has devolved into a siege. General Lovell, who commands the American ground component, has written back to Boston for reinforcements to attack the fort, and General McLean, who commands the British forces in this battle, has written to British-controlled New York City for a Royal Navy fleet to come sail up to where he is in Penobscot Bay, part of Maine today, then part of Massachusetts, and destroy the American fleet and rescue his last stand. So essentially what we have now is a race for which side could get reinforcements to the scene first, an age where every message had to be carried by sailing ship, horseback, or by foot. And so we find ourselves on August 2nd, 1779, 9 days after the 40-ship American fleet sailed into Penobscot Bay. With the British and the Americans both dug in on the Braggadoce Peninsula, Commodore Saltonstall spent the day scouting on land for a location which would allow his sailors to build a defensible battery to then fire down on the British fleet from. So another day passes in stalemate, and the next day a battery is built on the Braggadoce Peninsula where this deadly game of chicken is playing out. On August 4th, the battery is complete, and it is at extreme long cannon range. It's able to do some light damage to the British warships, but not enough to force them from their defensive position where they are not moving from because it is, again, a great defensive position that despite the American fleet's overwhelming firepower, they really just can't crack. There are some more minor skirmishes in the woods outside of the American entrenchment lines that are being used to besiege the British fort, but for the most part, another day passes without major action on either side. On August 5th, both sides keep building defensive positions, and yet another day passes while both sides wait for reinforcements. The next day, General Lovell and Commodore Saltonstall had separate discussions, separate war councils, about each of their proposed strategies. And so General Lovell had it with the Army guys, and Commodore Saltonstall had it with his captains. The Army War Council concluded that the Navy should go capture the harbor before they stormed the fort, and the Navy War Council concluded that this was a suicide mission, given the firing angles that the fort had on the harbor, the defensive position of the British fleet, which was again excellent, and some other factors. The main other factor, which I've touched on a little bit in previous episodes, was the tide and the wind patterns, combined with the technical limitations of square-rigged vessels of the era. In most histories of the Penobscot Expedition, this is overlooked, and the, spoiler alert, disaster which befell the Penobscot Expedition is blamed on Commodore Saltonstall for cowardice and incompetence on this and other junctures in which he did not take the harbor despite superior numbers of ships and sailors. But after a lot of reading, I fall pretty squarely into the camp that runs opposed to this popular narrative. Although Saltonstall lost the public relations battle at the time and since, it seems to me that everyone who has done a serious study of the conditions since then has come to the conclusion that either Commodore Saltonstall was right, and that any assault was somewhere in between extremely risky and downright idiotic. And so I'm going to take a few paragraphs from John Bucher's book on the Penobscot Expedition here, where he draws on the handful of previous accounts, as well as his own analysis, to essentially argue that Saltonstall was right to refuse to storm the harbor again, without the Army at least doing a simultaneous attack on the fort to divert some of that cannon fire that would otherwise be directed at them. At this point, General Lovell has refused to do that simultaneous assault because he feels that he doesn't have the men and he can't sort of trust the men he has, given that they are the dregs of the Massachusetts militia for the most part. And so here is that passage from George Bucher. Quote, "Other officers, experienced in sailing, gave their opinion of how Saltonstall should have attacked British naval commander Captain Mowat's vessels. Rear Admiral Colby M. Chester, U.S. Navy, served on sailing ships during the Civil War, surveyed the coast of Maine, and worked in the hydrographic office in Washington. In retirement, he made a critical analysis of the Penobscot Expedition. He considered that the narrow channel, the wind conditions of the region made it, quote, almost impossible for wind-propelled vessels of any considerable size to maneuver in the Bragadeuse River except at slack water, and then only when the wind is favorable. The idea that American ships entering into the harbor of Bragadeuse under the conditions, meaning the conditions of the land batteries and the British ships would be in, would be foolhardy in the extreme, except as a last resort, end quote. Captain Elliot Rappaport of the Maine Maritime Academy schooner Bowden sailed out of Castine, which is nearby harbor, for 8 years. He said that if he planned an attack in a square-rigged ship, he would wait for a flood tide in the afternoon with a southwest wind to sail in as quickly as possible. After destroying the sloops of war, he knew that he would have to go beyond the British guns to wait for darkness to leave on the ebb tide when the wind was calm. The current reversed 2 or 3 knots, sometimes as strong as 4 or 5 knots, depending on the full moon tide, a spring, or an ebb tide. Captain Robin Walbridge of the Tallship Bounty Foundation sailed the HMS Bounty for 14 years. After looking at the Penobscot River chart, he said that winds from the 130 through 330 degrees would be good for entering, but a square-rigged vessel could not leave under those winds. If he had to enter under Saltonstall's conditions, he wanted either a strong breeze or the ebb tide, so that if his vessel received damage, he could drift out of the harbor, or preferably, have the flood in and have the wind push him out. Captain Bailey looked at the Penobscot River navigation chart and a copy of Calef's chart and said, quote, it would be very easy to get in there in a southwesterly breeze, but it might be another matter to get out. You would be committed to staying for a while. He did not want to speculate on Saltonstall's options, for there are too many unknown intangibles for him to venture an answer. Captain Austin Becker of the Providence Maritime Heritage Foundation sailed the Continental Sloop Providence for 2 years. He felt that entering Bragadeuse Harbor with a southwesterly breeze would be easy, but leaving would be difficult, even for a sloop, and a sloop is a very maneuverable type of ship. His sloop, without engine power, could get no closer to windward than 60 degrees, or 70 degrees if he carried his square-rigged topsail. The narrowness of the harbor entrance would also necessitate a slow passage while tacking to exit. After examining John Calef's map of Bragadeuse and his navigation chart, he exclaimed, oh, that was Commodore Saltonstall's damned hole. Which, if you recall from the previous episode, is what Saltonstall called the entering of the Bragadeuse Harbor, because it was just this, you know, hole where there was no wind, very not maneuverable, and they were basically sitting ducks in very disadvantageous conditions. George Bucher continues, Michael Nancaro, professor of mathematics at Jacksonville University, has enabled us to visualize Saltonstall's problem mathematically. To simplify the problem, he assumed that the Americans needed to sail 1 nautical mile to get out of the harbor after engaging the enemy ships. He also assumed that they would be sailing into the wind with negligible current and tacking at an angle of 80 degrees in a channel 660 yards wide. He came to the following conclusions, quote, to proceed 1 mile sailing directly into the wind under the assumed conditions, a ship would have had to travel a distance of 5.76 nautical miles. It would have had to tack 19.14 times, so tack is in turn, and it was traveling at 2 nautical miles per hour, so that is less than walking pace. It would have taken 2.88 hours to travel 1 mile, end quote. And of course, judging from maps, it is apparent that the American ships would have had to sail farther than 1 mile after engaging enemy sloops. So basically, the ships would be under fire as they approached the British ships. They would have to defeat them, and then they would have to keep going through enemy fire while the fort was still firing down on them, get out of range, and then at night, go back through when the cannons at the fort weren't that accurate, and get back out into the main Penobscot Bay Harbor. I mean, crazy, right? And that's why Saltonstall didn't want to do it. And so back to Bucher. Throughout their departure from Bragadeuse Harbor, they would have been subjected to fire from the Citadel, that's the fort the British were building, which was above and beyond their own gun range, so they couldn't have hit it. It would have been a harrowing several hours of defenseless travel, end quote. So basically, it would have been, you know, a close to suicide mission. All these people had sailing ship experience, who had a lot of experience, oftentimes in those exact waters, were agreeing with Saltonstall that this was a not good option when that fort was firing down on you, which is why Saltonstall didn't want to do it unless the fort was distracted with a land assault. And so again, right, to summarize, All this is to say that Commodore Saltonstall was probably right not to sail into Bragadous Harbor alone and unafraid. We have a lot of notes from the various war councils that Commodore Saltonstall held with his ship captains, and I think it's pretty telling that none of the captains, zero of them, ever disagreed in the slightest or raised any serious possibility of doing this assault alone. And the captains, they very much argued about all sorts of things, but they never seemed to disagree on the fact that this was an unbelievably risky assault, bordering on suicide mission. I think it was just unanimously acknowledged as extremely foolish because it really didn't enter the discussion much. It was just a non-starter. And so back to the story. On August 7th, General Lovell called another council of war for both the land and the naval officers, so a joint council of war. And Lovell wanted to know that in light of the two separate war councils the day before, so the Army and the Navy separate ones, what his options were here. Commodore Saltonstall suggested that either, quote, strike a bold stroke by storming the enemy's works and going in with ships, or raise the siege, end quote. General Lovell replied that he was, quote, not in a situation with his present force to storm, end quote, and then asked Saltonstall, quote, whether there was a sufficient number of sailors to defend the ships to carry on any further operations, end quote. And Saltonstall replied that due to the desertions among his impressed seamen, that this was somewhat improbable for much longer. Of the 10 assault ship captains, so the warships present, five of them didn't feel they could carry on operations much longer. If you remember back from the second episode in this miniseries, a lot of the seamen from this expedition were recruited against their will, and they were being kept for longer than their original contract said. And these seamen, yeah, they're not stupid, or at least a lot of them aren't stupid. They can see that this is not a great situation to be in. And all these ships, all these warships, they're in harbor, and the sailors are going ashore for work parties, they're lugging cannons, they're collecting water. And if a sailor didn't particularly want to be part of a crew, it was definitely a risky proposition if he got caught, but it wasn't too risky of a proposition to just melt away into the woods. There was some more tactical back and forth, with the conclusion on General Lovell's part that there were not enough men to storm the British fort. The war councils actually featured a lot of voting among senior officers that I've glossed over thus far, but it speaks to the lack of unified command structure, not just among the land and the naval components where there was no one in charge, but within each component, the senior officers, meaning Lovell and Saltonstall, needed a majority buy-in of their captains to make some major decisions. Which is just absolutely not how the military works today, but, you know, it's talking to a totally different era, right? Sort of pretty foreign, right? And so General Lovell, he asked the War Council to vote on whether the siege should continue or not. 13 voted to continue the siege, including Commodore Saltonstall, so that he could present a unified command front of General Lovell, who was not going to back down. Eight commanders voted to end the siege, including the commander of the expedition's artillery, Lieutenant Colonel Paul Revere, because, quote, if we could not dislodge the enemy in 7 days, we ought to quit the ground. For where the enemy has command of the sea, and the fate of the expedition depends on the movements, on that element, we ought not to risk so much as we did, end quote. So despite Paul Revere's reservations, the War Council did end on a 13-8 vote, and they closed essentially without making a final decision, and in the meantime decided to just continue the siege until information arrived from Boston with news of when reinforcements were arriving and or intelligence of the British movements. And to that, I just have to say, what on earth? This is clearly not a sound tactical decision. The internal politics of the situation are clearly clouding the judgments of a lot of the people involved. They are risking total ruin of the expedition on the gamble that reinforcements from Boston will arrive before the expedition gets trapped in Penobscot Bay. And to me, this just seems monumentally stupid. And it seems that at least some of the quite literal yes men did not want to retreat as failures and be known for this back home. But I mean, come on, this is war, right? Put aside your ego. I've tried to look at this situation objectively and not shade the decisions with what I know now looking back with the benefit of hindsight and knowing what the British records have to say, etc. And I do this a lot. I usually try to see the logic behind what we in history now know is a dumb decision. You know, for example, attacking Pearl Harbor. Dumb, stupid on the Japanese part. But I can at least steel man the case for the Japanese. It was a bad, stupid gamble, but at least there was a shred of logic there. But this, I mean, like, again, it's a gamble, but it is a bad gamble. But I'll pick it up again with Paul Revere, where he says, quote, "The general said that he could not subdue the enemy without reinforcements of men and stores. The field officers of the militia said their men would not face the enemy in open ground. Six captains of the armed vessels said their men were so uneasy and deserted so fast that if we stayed 3 days longer, they should not have enough men left to work their vessels. That they had been there 8 days longer than they had expected, were in danger of reinforcement of the enemy, and should a superior fleet to theirs arrive, we should lose the whole fleet." End quote. Yes, Paul Revere, you are absolutely correct. The risk-reward ratio is not good. The Americans have a superior number of men. They have a huge number of ships, which represents a monumental investment. And the British have an inferior number of men and three ships. And so you are gambling a disproportionate amount on, we'll call it maybe a 50-50 proposition that your reinforcements will arrive first. I mean, honestly, probably less than 50-50, because getting the fleet to transport the land reinforcements and the land reinforcements is going to take longer than just getting a fleet, because the British don't have to get the land reinforcements. They just have to get a fleet to go defeat the American fleet. And so this is a bad gamble. It's like if I offer you, hey, you want to bet $10 against my $1 on a coin flip? I'll take that all day long if I'm the British. But yeah, bad choices here. So rant over. This Council of War presented Commodore Saltonstall with a choice of equally unsatisfactory alternatives. General Lovell and his officers turned down supporting the Commodore's assault ships and all-out frontal attack on the British forces, in part because General Lovell was relying on the dregs of the Massachusetts militia, who might not listen to his orders. The majority of the officers overrode the assault ship captain's desire to raise the siege if the land force could not support the attack, and simultaneously, the majority of all the officers present, mainly the land-based officers, overrode via vote the assault ship captain's desire to raise the siege if the land force would not support their attack on Bragadous Harbor. The assault captains, you know, correctly, for the most part, believed that their losses would be unacceptable without the assistance of the land force. And so every day it just brought the possibility of British reinforcement. And even though Commodore Saltonstall had increasing reservations about the wisdom of staying, it's not like he could take all of his ships and sail off and abandon the army to its fate. Oh, wait, actually, he could do that, since, again, no unified command structure. But that would have been a pretty messed up thing to do, to leave 1,000 soldiers to their fate. And so he wasn't going to do that. And both sides are sort of held hostage by the other here, but more so Commodore Saltonstall by the land element than vice versa. And so the siege continues more or less by default. There were skirmishes and jockeying for position on the Bragadous Peninsula, and over the next 5 days, the stalemate continued. Finally, with desertions mounting among an increasingly demoralized expedition, and really as a last-ditch effort, another war council agreed that a joint Army-Navy assault on the fort should take place. Despite the general poor performance of General Lovell's militia against the British regulars and desertion among the men besieging the fort, the Americans still had the numerical advantage on the ground. Hopefully, the land assault would distract enough of the British fort's firepower to allow the naval force enough cannon fire reprieve from that British fort to approach the defenseless British line of warships and then use superior numbers to batter them into submission. In Commodore Saltonstall's own words, the situation had gotten so dire and he was so scared of the impending British fleet that would trap his own, they said, quote, "The destruction of the enemy ships must be effected at any rate, although it might cost us half our own," end quote. And half our own, meaning roughly a 2.5-to-1 ratio. This is not a good trade, but he's willing to make it. And so finally, on August 13th, the assault is ready. Now, undermanned, it's 3 weeks late and desperate for resolution. Saltonstall's ships and Lovell's soldiers are prepared to conduct a joint assault. Unfortunately for them, in the sea haze at the mouth of the Penobscot Bay, the first sightings of tall masts and white sailcloth bobbed its way into view. Although the Americans deep in the bay didn't know it yet, Admiral Sir George Collier had just arrived with the Royal Navy. The Americans were now trapped. And that is where I'm going to leave this episode. The next one will be out next week, and it is going to be an absolute bloodbath. It is truly a naval defeat of epic proportion. So tune in. If you feel like supporting the show, you can shoot me an email at usnavalhistorypodcast@gmail.com. You can give me a rating on Spotify. You can give me a rating on Apple Podcasts. You can support the show financially. There is a link in the podcast description and in the podcast show description. Or you can go to my website, usnavalhistory.com. You can subscribe for as little as $3 a month. Thank you very much for those of you who have subscribed. And of course, you can always help spread the word by telling your friends, hey, I know this great podcast. You might like it. It's called the U.S. Naval History Podcast. And until next time, fair winds and following seas. Thanks, guys.